Welcome to the 61st episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel, and this might be the first episode we do where Kalen keeps his eyes closed the entire episode.
I'm going to see what it's like to sleep and do the podcast at the same time.
Great. You know what that is for listeners? A bonanza.
Well, they don't know. Pleasure. They wouldn't know if you hadn't said. I can tell by your
lackadaisical attitude.
This is amazing. This is weird. Like, I'm going to make my body as unarticulated as possible and then keep this dynamism in my voice so that you have a really disconnected and like cognitively dissonant experience, but they can't tell the difference.
We're
gonna find out how this affects you.
No, it seems like you're a really charismatic paraplegic. Yeah. I love it.
This is what it's great. Would be like.
Yeah, this is what it's like, or quadriplegic even.
I'm also blind. Like, there was a really bad accident.
But the thing is, I don't judge people by how they look.
Exactly. Kid. My heart is still in it.
I know, I can tell. I'm going to turn your mic down.
Same spirit in that guy.
Yeah,
You even have to turn my mic down. That's how good I sound.
Well, it's
that's how enthusiastic.
It's because
I
your lackadaisical way of
you know
laying
what's weird is as
is
you talked about
very close to your
as
mouth.
You just but because you mentioned paraplegia, I had to wiggle my toes.
Just to make sure.
Yeah.
Die Hard with a Vengeance, guys. We're into it.
Wait a minute. Can I say something about last week?
Yeah, please.
I've been really struggling with it. I loved it. I thought it was a really incredible episode. Obviously, it was massively long. And to anybody who made it all the way through, thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll send you a postcard if you give us your address.
And if you happen to love Return of the Jedi, I apologize. But I feel bad. I kind of feel bad about it. It was one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. But in the aftermath, I feel like, man, like, we were hard on poor Return of the Jedi.
Can I be honest with you? I think it's important to confront your sacred cows, so to speak, here. You know, there's something. It's the point of the podcast is we take things that we think we love and we look at them and with objective eyes. I am really surprised how I tried hard to make this objective. I'd seen it last year. And
did you try hard with a vengeance? I couldn't have done that if I had my eyes open.
I know, because you would have seen my disgust and anger in my eyes. I had two experiences with it, maybe 8 months apart, which is seeing it desperately wanting someone else to like it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I'd made them watch it, and then trying to see it with a fresh pair of eyes through the eyes of nostalgia and saying, okay, cool, let's look at this as you know, Travis in 2017.
I guess part of what I mean is like, I know people love it and it's important to them that they love it. And even if I think it's a god-awful piece of art, I feel bad. I know it's the premise of the show on some level, but I feel bad when it goes that way.
It's interesting because it is. Here's why I think you feel bad, and I think you're right to feel bad, is that it's different than Short Circuit. When we watch Short Circuit and you run into someone on the street and you say, we watch Short Circuit, they go, that movie's awesome. You go, no, it's not. They're not like,
yeah.
Fuck you. They're like, no,
that won't
what?
Make them cry.
Yeah, but when someone says they love Return of the Jedi, they usually know what they mean. It's not that they haven't seen it recently, Short Circuit or like Cocoon or something like that. They probably have seen it in the last 5 years.
Yeah,
and they do love it.
You know what?
It's different.
Exactly. I don't think this was the nature of the conversation that we had, but I do feel, I hope that no one takes that and says like, wow, you don't like me or you think my opinion is worthless. And that's not ever what I want this show to be about. So,
well, there is,
they didn't take that from it.
They could have. I mean, there's something to be said though, is that I don't mind if you like Return of the Jedi, but I do mind if you say Return of the Jedi is a good film.
Right.
I think there's something different there.
Oh, that's cool. That helps. That helps me.
Yeah. I
that's how I'll approach it from now on.
Yeah. I don't think I'm offended if someone says, I love Return of the Jedi. I wouldn't. If someone says, I love Short Circuit, I'd be like, what are you talking about? But if someone says, I love Return of the Jedi, I wouldn't necessarily assume I understood what they meant by that. And I have to ask them, well, what do you like about it? What do you mean?
Right.
And then it may not be the film. It may not be the fact that it's a well-acted or well-made film.
Yep. Something that is adored that much, it's just not fun to have an argument about to me. And I think there are people who get off on that. And I think that there's a version of this show where we sort of get juiced on that. No, I don't think that's true. That's not true. Anyway, so Die Hard with a Vengeance. Die Hard 3. We're going to skip Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 2, and just like the Star Wars trilogy, we're going to go right to are there as many? There are more Star Wars movies than Die Hard movies, right? But only like a
there's
couple.
There's 8 Star Wars films.
Right. And there's 5 Die Hard films. Mm-hmm. And this is where, for me, the Die Hard series stops. I haven't seen Die Hard 4 and Die Hard 5. Have you?
I've seen Die Hard... Full stop. That's it.
Oh, that's it.
Yep. So I don't know what this movie is.
Oh, my. Okay, yeah, well, let me pitch it to you. I mean, look, I haven't seen this thing in 20 years.
You've probably seen it once, right?
Yeah, I probably saw it a couple of times. Okay, but I saw it like 2 times.
All right, what's the movie? Tell me the movie.
Well, do you want the Hollywood origin? I'll just tell it this way. So, John McTiernan came back to the series to make Die Hard
3. So he didn't do Die Hard Returns.
Rennie Harlan made Die Hard 2 Die Harder. And then McTiernan came back to do Die Hard with a Vengeance, which was originally a script called Simon Says. And it was sold or whatever to Paramount or I don't know who. And then at some point it was one of those stories where they were like, you know what? This would be a good Die Hard movie. And then it was retrofitted to incorporate John McClane and carry the series forward. So that's kind of interesting. And you'll see that it has very directly connected to Die Hard 1. But my memory of it is almost completely separate from Die Hard 1 because it's a very, very different kind of a action adventure cop story, in that it's kind of a goose chase. Like it's Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson running around New York trying to stop a mad bomber guy. And he's playing games. Simon, his name is Simon. He's like, Simon says, you know, stop this bomb. You only have 1 hour. And they're
I'm kind of into that.
Oh, it's awesome. I think it's really good.
Okay.
Cool. I remember it being very, very fun.
Because I get how that could be a thing. I'm in the mood for something just like that, to be honest with you.
It's a cool, cool action movie. And McTiernan is strong. He was strong. We've already done one of his movies in Predator.
Do Samuel L. Jackson, who I did not know was in this film, do they have like a contentious, fun, combative buddy cop relationship?
Of course they do.
And is it rewarding?
Yeah.
Is it better than the buddy cop films we've done so far?
What have we done so far?
We did Men in Black.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to find out. I don't know this movie very well.
Who's the curmudgeon in that relationship? Because I could imagine they could both be curmudgeonly. Because John McClane feels
they're
like curmudgeon.
They're kind of both curmudgeons.
How the fuck does that work?
It's two curmudgeons.
It's two Gary Buseys.
Yeah. It is. It's like Nick Nolte and Nick Nolte.
Jesus. That sounds terrible.
No, I think it's very fun. I mean, look, it's Samuel L. Jackson immediately before popping big time in Pulp Fiction. I mean, I think that it's, or maybe it's, I want to say this is 93.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, ooh, okay, so I just remembered this movie was semi-controversial when it came out because it depicts a bombing in New York City, and it came out like the day after or like the week after or something, month after, whatever. I think the first World Trade Center bombing? Remember that? Oh, no, it came
Oklahoma
out after
City,
Oklahoma
mean?
City.
Yeah.
It came out after Oklahoma City, and people were like, we don't find bombings fun anymore.
Right.
And so it ran up into sort of a controversy where people were like, we're not sure this is the right moment for this film, but they released it anyway. So what year was Oklahoma City?
93.
Is that okay, right? Great. I think so this came out in 93, yeah. Pulp Fiction 94. So Samuel L. Jackson he's really good in it, but it's interesting that he hadn't burst out in this star-making performance yet.
Yeah.
He was just a solid character actor who got this part. And I think he's great in it, as I recall. He's being very Samuel L. Jackson.
I am interested to see what the I've become, since we watched Men in Black, kind of thinking through a lot of different I was wrong. Oklahoma City bombing is 95.
Ooh, maybe it was 95.
Just FYI.
Well, then it would be post-Pulp Fiction, which changes my entire premise.
Let's look all this up. By the way, Galen has now opened his eyes and is on his phone, everybody. So his whole plot has failed.
Yeah, but can you see my eyes?
Yeah.
No, you can't.
You don't know.
Yes, I do.
How do you know?
Because if you could see my eyes, I could see your face.
That is not good reasoning.
Of course it is.
So you've never been able to see someone when they're looking at something else and they don't know that you're looking at them?
My hat is over my eyeballs. There's no way you can see my eyes.
You know what's good podcasting? All visual references to what's in the room with you.
This was 1995. You're right. He's post-Pulp Fiction, people.
Interesting. Changes the
we
whole thing.
We are through the looking glass.
Edit and recut this because we're back to a different place.
Now we have a different thing to look at then, which is, you know, Samuel L. Jackson confronting newfound stardom. You know, he's coming off of Jules Winfield, one of the great characters of all time,
uh-huh.
And playing, moving that into a mainstream, non-indie space.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, cool. Great. I do want to see how these different pairings, because I was thinking and talking to, listen, this is a little bit of a detour, but I've been reading for this other writing job I have, some erotic romance. And one of the things I noticed about erotic romance is it is down the pipe formulaic romance structure in terms of film stuff. It's three acts. There's the first act where they hate each other, the second act where they're sort of working it out, and then the third act they have to come together to do some external thing or whatever. Anyway, yeah. So it's following this, but it's also following the buddy cop formula, because totally. Buddy cops are romance.
Well, it's right? Kind of a brilliant idea to turn... I mean, you know, obviously there's a buddy element to Die Hard 1, which, you know, Bruce Willis and Reginald Vell Johnson, you know, they have kind of a friendly relationship.
I would say Reginald Vell Johnson. You said Vell Johnson.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Vell Johnson?
Yeah, Reginald Vell Johnson.
Vell Johnson.
I respect that. Go on.
Can you recite the ingredients of a Twinkie? And so in this movie, I like the idea of making that the folk, like turning the Die Hard formula into a buddy cop formula. That seems kind of funny and unusual.
Yeah, actually. I like that idea. I'm really interested to see it. And just because I've been thinking through in terms of plotting erotic romance, I've been thinking through other buddy cop films.
Yeah,
just
exactly. And I guess what I mean is that Die Hard built this very, very functional action movie formula, which was then co-opted and remade essentially a zillion times by a zillion different movies, which we're doing, like, you know, Speed is Die Hard on a bus, Speed 2 is Die Hard on a boat, Sudden Impact is Die Hard in a hockey arena. You know that famous movie, Sudden Impact?
Mm-mm.
Cool. Well, it's Die Hard in a hockey arena.
I mean, with that, like, pitch, I'm kind of into it.
Yeah, stars Jean-Claude Van Damme. I may be mistaking Sudden Impact for something else.
Double Impact is Jean-Claude Van Damme. Does he have two Impact movies?
Well, he's in some movie that's Die Hard in a hockey arena. And I don't remember what it is. Anyway, but we all know that, like, they've milked this Die Hard formula a lot. And so I love the idea that Die Hard, the series itself, just goes for a different genre. It's kind of funny and cool.
Yeah, I like that.
And obviously we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Bruce, who in 95 is probably at the peak of his powers. He's also post-Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
So this is a totally post-Pulp Fiction action movie.
Yeah.
How about that?
It definitely is. And they had no scenes together in Pulp Fiction, do they?
They did. Well, they didn't. They didn't really interact, but they were in the same environment.
Okay.
Very briefly.
Yeah, I don't remember them on screen together, but I'm sure they were. Okay. Well, I'll tell you, I am excited about this film. I have always wanted to go back and watch all the Die Hard movies. I have never done that. It just never seemed like the right time.
Are you upset that you're skipping Die Hard 2?
A little, honestly, yeah. I wish I would go back. I know everyone in the film industry has Die Hard memorized. I don't have it memorized.
Right.
I've seen it. I don't have a special connection to the film. But if I had my druthers, I'd go watch Die Hard again, which is not the sequel to Die Hard.
Well,
I'd
go
watch
funny,
Die Hard, period.
What's funny is I just did that. Like, oddly, we were like, I forget when it was. It might have been Christmas, actually. It might have been this past Christmas where we were like, you know what we should do is show Lily Die Hard.
Yeah, sure.
And so we did, and it was awesome. It was really great. It was really fun to watch. And Lily, she's so predictable with her response to everything we ever show her, which is like, why am I watching this? I don't want to watch this for the first 30 seconds and just miserable to 31 seconds being like, this is so fun and great. And she's talking it up and loving it.
That
and
describes your relationship with Eve, though, to be fair. So it
No. Yeah, that's
as
not
I
true.
Recall it.
No, that's not true. That's Lily. That's Lily in movies. But yeah, it was great. So I love that. So I'm going to be able to talk a lot about Die Hard. It was very fresh in my mind as we record this.
I wish Eve wants to say something. Sorry.
Yes, Eve?
No, I just didn't hear what described our relationship.
He's just being dumb. Don't listen to him.
I'll tell you off air, because I think you'll agree with me. I wish I had watched Die Hard. I wish I had watched Die Hard, Die Harder?
Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Die Hard 2, Die Harder. And before this. So yes, that is a little bit of a regret. I hope it will not impact my viewing enjoyment. And I'm ready to do it. I'm ready to just get into this thing and have a nice, rousing action movie time.
I am too. Cannot wait. Here we go.
They're headed east on 72nd towards the park.
But Wall Street is south.
Man, stop yelling at me. I got a bad headache. And the best way south is not 9th Avenue. It's through the park.
I told you the park drive is always jammed.
I didn't say park drive.
I said through the park.
Out of the way!
Oh. Now, get out of here!
been a little bit of time, Caitlin.
Since we recorded the intro, it's been a weird. Yeah, we've had a weird run, but let's talk about all that on the end of this thing. What did you think of Die Hard with a vengeance?
It was quite vengeful. I had a really, really good time in this movie until like the last 5 minutes, I guess. are a couple sort of things to talk about from my perspective, but what did you think about it?
I just watched it this morning.
Is fresh. I watched it more than 24 hours ago.
Oh my God.
I know. It's really fading.
I thought it was phenomenally entertaining.
Yeah.
What a phenomenally entertaining film.
Yeah. I'll tell you what it made me miss.
Yeah.
The opening sequence is, I think, awesome. It's completely practical effects. Basically, it's this Love and Spoonful song playing over beautiful shots of New York, sort of establishing these, you know, how the streets work and just giving you nice sentimental shots of New York. And then it's interrupted by this blast. I mean, this massive blast that knocks over a security truck. It's clearly a practical effect. It's awesome.
Very good explosion.
It's a great bomb.
Oh, explosion. For sure. And I mean, you know, that's the thing that got people all worked up. And in 1996, which we alluded to in the intro, coming as it did right after Oklahoma City. And I have since read a little bit about that, which is that, you know, they were nervous about the release, whatever. It was on everybody's mind. And Bruce Willis at one point said, you know, he instructed or asked interviewers not to ask him about it. Like, don't bring it up. And he said, don't bring it up because to do so would trivialize an actual atrocity by putting it in the context of this dumb
that's
movie.
Some judo shit.
Very smart. That's very judo. Smart thing to say.
Yeah, that's social judo.
But it was really cool. I mean, God, there are a lot of things to talk about. I want to just first try to stick to the movie, which is so cool on this show, on this podcast, in the context of this podcast is, you know, we haven't watched Die Hard on the show, but I think we've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did watch Predator, which is also John McTiernan. And we did watch True Lies.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, like, this movie's fucking way better than True Lies.
Oh, infinitely better than True Lies.
But it's weirdly similar. Like,
it is, but it's... Here's the thing. It feels like a really, really good 80s action film, but it's coming in a later time period.
Yes. Well, I have a lot of thoughts about that.
Tell me.
I'll tell you now. Well, I guess is that what this show's for?
Well, I don't
to tell
know.
You my
I,
thoughts?
I don't know, but I have thoughts about the same issue, and you share them. Let's talk about
those
issues.
Well, I just straight up loved the movie for an hour, fully, like completely. And that's every sequence, you know, in the first half,
mm-hmm.
Which includes the subway sequence, which is fucking awesome, where
so
the subway
good.
Breaks and shatters through the station.
Should I just give a quick plot?
I guess
you
so.
Do it?
I guess so.
All right. So here's the deal. There is an explosion, as aforementioned, and the police department gets a phone call from a guy who's claiming to be the guy who set this bomb off, who is named Simon, who has these riddles where he says, Simon says, blah, 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 blah. And he says...
so much to say about the riddles.
Well, we'll get to that. He says, I want John McClane. And I want John McClane to do this thing for me, or I'm going to set off another bomb, so it's your call. And he hangs up. And so they wrestle a hungover John McClane out, who's, again, at odds with his wife and and drinking again and smoking. And we don't know what this thing is yet, but...
what he's being forced to
do. Yeah, and so all of a sudden he shows up, and we see him take his clothes off, and he puts on a sandwich board and goes out and steps out of the back of this police truck. And then he's walking around. We still don't know what this sandwich board
says. And just boxers wearing a sandwich board.
Yeah.
Some part of, you know, kind of rough New York.
Yeah, but we don't know at this point what it is. And then we have a brief scene with Samuel L. Jackson, who is a basically a repair shop sort of pawn shop owner guy. And we then see that this sign says, I hate N-words, and we realize he's in Harlem wearing this. And Samuel L. Jackson comes out and basically saves John McClane's life by throwing him into a cab, and everybody gets banged up a little bit. Anyway, so that's how it opens.
So that jams these two characters who don't know each other together.
Yeah, and Simon's like, okay, who's this other guy, and what are you doing? And you messed up my plan.
Very, very, you know, convivially for him, he's like, well, I guess he's part of the show now.
Yeah,
like, he's in.
Straight up.
For no reason.
He even asked, where's the other guy?
Yeah. He's just like, you guys are a team. I don't know him.
Yeah.
I obviously have some specific beef with you, but that's okay.
He's in.
He's in.
So I don't want to go through all the different riddles and things, but what basically unfolds is that this Simon guy is giving John McClane and the NYPD a bunch of different bombs to go disarm and a bunch of riddles to sort of disarm them. There's a moment where he
throwing them all across the city.
Yeah, running around and around and around. We'll get to the actual subway one that Kalen's talking about, but he basically blows up a subway car, and we're told as an audience that he was going to blow that up regardless. It was an impossible task. We almost did it, but he was going to blow it up regardless. And then he says, "There's a bomb somewhere. 2,400 pounds of explosives are in some school somewhere in New York, and I'm not going to tell you which one." And so he basically sends all the cops in New York scattering to all the schools, leaving the site of the bomb blast from the subway unattended. The bomb blast happens to be next to the New York Federal Reserve, and we quickly realize this is a heist, not a necessarily a John McClane thing. Although it turns out that the main henchman, Simon, is Hans Gruber's brother
from Die Hard 1.
Simon Gruber.
So Alan Rickman, famously the bad guy Hans Gruber in Die Hard 1, this is his brother played by Jeremy Irons.
The idea that Alan Rickman and Jeremy Irons are brothers is my favorite thing.
It's pretty fantastic.
It's fucking great casting.
Also, you know what's really weird about that, just very quickly?
Yeah.
Thinking, like, until I rewatched Die Hard, this is going to sound crazy to people who are listening to this who like Die Hard. I get it. And I know their names are Hans Gruber and Simon Gruber. I know. I get it. I'm saying, when I think about Die Hard, before I watched it this time, I wouldn't have told you he was German. I would have been like, yeah, Alan Rickman's being fucking awesome Alan Rickman. He's like a British guy. Then on this one, I was surprised again that he was German, even though I'd just seen Die Hard. And I knew it was his brother. But I was like, yeah, Jeremy Irons, he's like doing his fucking, you know,
weird phone voice.
Yeah, his British thing. No, he's German.
There's this amazing sequence where Jeremy Irons is doing a German accent trying to do a Southern accent. Yeah. And there's these layers of accents where he's impersonating a dude for some other cops. And it's really crazy.
It's pretty weird.
Yeah, it's really weird. I wanted to watch that part twice.
But in my memory, it's just two British brothers that he has to take out, but not the case.
Gruber.
Anyway.
Yeah, there's a lot of German subplots to this film. Not to belabor all the things, this is a 2-hour and 10-minute movie, but we find out John McClane catches on to the fact that this is a gold heist. It's got, you know, twice as much gold as Fort Knox. They take it, they load it into trucks, and there's a mad
ten
dash.
10 times as much gold as Fort Knox.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
And then they have a mad dash to the docks where they're going to put all the gold on the ship, and then John McClane has to stop that, and then more riddles and more shooting and whatever.
Yeah.
All right.
That's it. That's all that happens.
Yeah.
And he saves the day.
He saves the fucking day.
What was I going to say? Oh, the subway. Well, the subway is amazing. And then I loved the gag of the reversal of, like, this has all been a distraction, and this has all been a setup to nail this Federal Reserve. I thought that was great.
Yep.
And it was such a cool trick, which they do in Die Hard 1 also, which is you somehow for a piece of the film are transported into, like, the joy of the heist from the bad guy's point of view. Like, they're playing this fucking Johnny Come Marching Home Again music while these guys awesomely raid this Federal Reserve with giant trucks and tanks and, like, they're hammering through walls. And you're like, man, these guys are awesome.
Also, Jeremy Irons is wearing a cut-off sleeve baby blue tee, which is the least sort of villain-esque shirt
I've
ever seen. It was
awesome. I loved it.
Also, side note.
I love watching him walk around.
Just so confident. So, side note on that, the screenwriter of this, I looked up this part because I was confused about the Federal Reserve part. The screenwriter got questioned by the FBI about this because they said he was way too close to how it actually works. And then after the movie came out, they leaked out and they said, this heist idea would have actually worked. Like, all the geography's right, and we're going to put in some new safety implementations because the screen.
No, you're
kidding. No, read it. Check it out online. The FBI was like, this is a really good idea, actually, and we're going to go ahead and put some extra security because this subway stop is way too close to the Federal Reserve. All this stuff. Yeah, so it's actually a really. And they asked the screenwriter, how did you know that you could drive trucks to the waterway through the tunnels? How did you know that this subway stop was as close to this? And how'd you know the Federal Reserve layout? Because you got it exactly right. Like, we looked at the set. They came and visited the set. And the screenwriter went, well, you guys gave me a tour of the Federal Reserve. I went and got the plans from City Hall for the pipes. It's all there.
No way.
Yeah. And he said, and then the other thing they asked, he's like, there's an article published about it last month. So here's all the, it's all public record. They went, oh, okay, sorry.
I just this, did by the way, the guy who also wrote Jumanji. for our show.
Is that true?
Well, one of them. One of the credited writers on Jumanji.
Because this movie's fun and you know, relatively smart.
Yeah, he has had an interesting career. It's worth looking him up. Jonathan Hensley. He's done a lot of big budget action films.
Jumanji.
A lot of which were unsuccessful.
Well, Jumanji.
Well, that's only one of them. But it wasn't. Didn't we say Jumanji was also written by the short? Oh no, that was Cocoon.
Yeah, that's Cocoon.
Never. Was it? I can't remember. So anyway, I loved it for an hour. I loved everything about it. And it was kind of the ultimate Die Hard sequel. And the movie is sort of very funny about completely ignoring the events of Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
They just act like it never happened.
I still never saw Die Hard 2.
But there are a lot of references to Die Hard 1, which makes it just sort of the direct sequel in certain ways. His wife's still in L.A. Mm-hmm. Like, he's still in New York. Like, they're still split. And I love the idea that his two adventures, if he only had two, let's say, are L.A. and New York. Mm-hmm. You know, it was weird and interesting in Die Hard that he's an NYPD cop ported into Los Angeles. And then here, it's like him on his own home turf.
This is related to what you're about to say.
It feels like New York.
There's a moment in the movie, about an hour, and I'm very curious to see where your turn happened. There's a moment about maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes in for me, where you realize, oh, this is just going to be a movie where they race from crisis to crisis to crisis.
Right.
And I kept waiting for something else to turn. And when I realized it wasn't going to, I was like, oh, fine. That's totally fine. And I settled back and I was into it.
Well, but I do think it kind of turned. I mean, yes, they continue that pattern, but they mix it up. It's not just this guy barking challenges at them anymore. Like, it turns in, you start to see that he has a grander design and you can see a different end game than just this guy goofs around until they catch him in the end. I liked the structure of it. Where I checked out, and I didn't check out at all. I really liked it, even all the way through. But I noted the 90s and the year that it came out at the point where, after all this great stuff, driving a cab through the park, and I don't know where the jugs part comes, but I want to talk about the jugs.
I really want
to talk about the jugs.
Yeah.
Literally, there's a part where...
Just stand by for that. He's not being gross. It's actual jugs.
Yeah, water jugs.
It's important.
There's a part where they're driving and they see the dump trucks. And he goes, this thing got airbags? And Samuel L. Jackson goes, well, your side does, but I don't know about McClane. Yeah. And then he drives off a bridge, and then they're fine.
Yeah.
And it's not that that scene was so bad, although I kind of rolled my eyes because nothing happens after this very realistic movie. I mean, roughly realistic for an hour. Then that they just had a superpower, super flying car. And I was like, okay. And then from then on, they don't get as hurt. And they do way crazier stuff.
Yeah.
Like when he gets fired at the pipe.
That's the part I want to talk about.
Yeah.
There's a really, let's walk through that real quick because I think it's helpful. And this is where I started to kind of be like, well, I don't know what the fuck's going on. But
right.
I didn't get aggravated until the last 5 minutes or so. But John McClane is chasing down these series of tubes. What's the best thing to call it? Tunnels, I guess. Man-made tunnels that are aqueducts, basically.
Aqueducts.
And so they're driving 18-wheelers through these things, and the bridge sort of has been dislodged. I'm not explaining this well, but there's these two. He can't move forward in the tunnels for whatever reason. Doesn't matter. So he can't chase them down. Jeremy Irons realizes he's right behind them. Decides, I'm going to flood the tunnels because we're almost out. Floods the tunnels. Massive amounts of water are coming. John McClane whips this 18-wheeler around in a really weird way. It's like a sports car.
He does a Blues Brothers turn.
Yeah,
Yeah. 180 flips his truck. Mack truck, like a big, gigantic dump truck. He turns it perfectly 180 degrees
and then
starts driving again.
And he's being chased by... I'm not criticizing this, but obviously CG water, and it's going, and then he has to climb out of his truck. The water catches up to him, and we've been told that there are, every 2 miles, there are sort of ventilation shafts that head up. He spots one of those, jumps up, and then climbs out into this ventilation shaft, and then the water's pressure is so high, it shoots him out like a little cork, and then he zoinks way up in the trees and comes down cartoonish-ish, and then who happens to be driving by right then is Samuel L. Jackson. He's like, what are you doing, John McClane? He's like, ugh, let's go.
Yeah.
That part is, they've just done.
Well, but what's funny is I like that scene. It's just like it takes you a little bit out of the experience of this film when you're kind of like, you can't believe it because it's so big and so great. But like Die Hard, you're like, man, like I kind of buy this guy getting bashed around and he's reacting like sort of a cool... but banged up and surprised guy. Like, he's scared and hurt a lot in the movie, which is kind of the hallmark of Die Hard for me. And that's all working. And you got this cool villain plan. You got all this great stuff. You got these cool, like, kind of side character cops who are interesting and unexpectedly odd. Like, did you think the chief of police had a wig on? Because I thought about it the entire movie. He has weird hair.
I didn't think that.
I
got hung up on Asif Manvi. Did you see him?
Oh, no.
He's the cab driver. They steal the cab from.
Oh, funny.
And I thought, that's got to be Asif Manvi. And I Googled it. And it was
incredible.
How weird.
Anyway, I was loving it. And then that was just where I was like, oh, they got this is where movies started to get the kind of like too big disease. Like basically what I was thinking is this is a world after Speed. Mm-hmm. And Speed has this problem in quotes a lot, where it's wildly unbelievable at every step of the way, but it kind of uses that to its tonal advantage. And Speed kind of invents funny stuff, like there's no way that this fucking bus would jump a freeway this way, but they play the absurdity and the fun of it. And I think this movie got a little bit of that, kind of caught that bug, and it's not really right for Die Hard,
but not till halfway through. You're right,
that's what I'm saying. That's what was odd.
I wouldn't even say halfway, I'd say like the last major sequence was about 45 minutes, I guess.
Yeah, more than that. But it starts to rear its head, and then suddenly that's the kind of the world that the movie lives in. And the characters, he still gets banged up, and it's cool. Like, there's a great shot of his arm bleeding and stuff, and he still looks all torn to shit, which is awesome. But he suddenly, and Samuel L. Jackson, they stop seeming like people in the same way. Mm-hmm. And what I liked best about it was them seeming like people in a totally crazy terrorist plot heist scenario. Mm-hmm. And so these are minor problems, because I thought it was really super fun. Honestly, all the way through, it is really gorgeously made. Like, it's a really beautiful, perfect kind of New York action movie. I just thought it was fucking
awesome. I'll tell you who, John McTiernan shoots action scenes like nobody's business.
Yeah.
I felt so happy watching. There's a number of car chases, there's a number of action sequences, and because they're being done practically, you don't get that Bourne sort of hyper Paul Greengrassy feel to it. There's constant wide shots showing you where everybody is in relation to everybody else. There's constant medium shots showing what you need to know. It's so you're never, ever, ever perplexed in pretty complicated choreographed action scenes.
Well, do you want to know? This is going to sound weird, maybe, but like what I was thinking watching this movie is like, oh yeah, there was a time where action movies were for grown-ups, but they were also totally fun. Mm-hmm. They were fun movies for grown-ups.
Yeah, these are fun
Yeah,
sequences.
And they're clearly adult. It's a totally adult audience movie. I mean, they swear a lot. There's surprising bloody violence in certain ways, kind of post-Pulp Fiction, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But it's not for kids. And anyway, it's not a PG-13 movie. And they would never sort of – it's just clearly not – but it's also – it's not going so hyperactively adult like the Bourne movies, which are PG-13 movies, ironically, which seems so fucking serious.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we are a legitimate piece of cinematic, you know, entertainment art. And like, this movie doesn't have any of that pretension.
The goal
but
is
it's way more
fun.
Beautiful. It's way more successful. And it is a good damn time to go to the theater to see a movie.
Yeah, and that 2-hour, 10-minute running time flies by.
It really did.
It flies
I was stunned.
By. No.
I gotta tell you, man, I was not... Not that I wasn't looking forward to seeing. Not that I wouldn't want to see this movie, but I'm like, I got a lot of shit going on. Like, my house is full of clothes that I'm packing to go on a vacation for a month, and I got to take care of these kids, and you know, it's Mother's Day today. Like, it's all this stuff is happening, and we're pitching other movies and all this stuff. And I was like, God, I got to fucking squeeze in 2 hours and 10 minutes of Die Hard. I can't do this right now.
Yeah.
As like 3 minutes into this thing, I was so happy to be watching it. Like, for real, all that kind of went
I'm
away.
I'm in the same situation. I had to put so many things on hold to do that.
Yeah.
And then I was transported.
Yeah.
Two things I want to talk about, if we could. One is, I think we should take 5 minutes into this episode and talk about what's going on in our careers. I think it's interesting.
Sure.
Because this is becoming a bit of a record of people who love movies sort of trying to make movies.
True.
The thing I want to talk about in terms of Die Hard with a Vengeance is the incredible attention or reliance on or interest in black-white race relations.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a couple things that happen in the movie. So obviously the opening scene... If you just pitch that to people, I tried it on and told my friends, hey, the opening of Die Hard is this. Did you know that? They're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
It seems so aggressive to modern eyes and audiences. And it certainly portrays this 90s Harlem as like a rough and tumble area where then people are going to pull out guns. And Samuel L. Jackson keeps saying, they'll kill you. The second they see you, they'll kill you.
Right.
And then they have these sort of gags, but also not gags, where Samuel L. Jackson is like, are you saying that because I'm black? Are you a racist? Do you not like me because I'm black? And then later on, John McClane goes, I think you're a racist. I think you're saying that because I'm white. And this comes up again, and I would say 5 times in the movie,
There's
attention paid. And it's almost the hallmark of the character dynamic between Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. And part of me thought, this feels dated. And part of me felt like this feels, I guess, maybe in the 90s progressive. And then I don't know how it sits now. I'm very perplexed by it.
An easy answer to any of that. But I would say that at the time, my guess is it played a little cliche, a little obvious, because much more, it's the kind of thing that much more serious films had taken on and explored. You know, many movies starring Samuel L. Jackson, you know, Do the Right Thing did that. I mean, there have been a lot of movies around this time about black-white relations and black-white cop relations to citizenry. And so that's not unusual, but it is very, I think that people probably would have seen that as kind of glib and kind of playing into the, you know, personality trope of Samuel L. Jackson.
I mean, it's supposed to be funny. Just tonally, it's presented
You know what's weird
way.
Is I guess it's supposed to be funny, but what was odd is like, I've seen it so much worse since, where I don't have specific examples, but like, you know, I don't even want to call out any because I can't say it with much authority. But like, there are things that don't feel as like that feel way more stupid. And what
Tales
I liked
from
about
the Hood
this movie,
or
not Tales from the Hood at all. That movie is way more. That movie's on it. I guess I kind of liked it because it struck me like they don't solve anything. They don't disabuse Samuel L. Jackson of the idea that he should not trust white people. He gets along with John McClane in the end because they've gone through this fucking war together. And it doesn't come to any conclusions about race relations.
Well, glib is the right word. It's almost the equivalent of, you wear plaid shirts, I fucking hate plaid shirts. And then that's the level to which they aggravate.
But I liked how Samuel L. Jackson played it. I didn't think he played it jokily.
They played it right.
And I actually liked a lot the scene that opened that narrative, which is him and his nephews. Oddly, he's taking care of his nephews, which they don't explain.
Yeah.
But they're obviously his kids, and he cares for them. And he tells them, you know, what are you going to do when you grow up? There's the kids like say this, like he's told them a million times, like, we're going to go to college. We're going to get a job. And he's like, and who's going to help you? And they're like, nobody. And he's like, well, what does that mean? Who's going to help you? And they're like, us. We're going to help ourselves. And he says, and who's not going to help you? And they say, white people. And then they go, there's a white guy out with a sign that says, I hate N-words. So anyway, but he does it that's not a joke scene. That's a totally legit, honest scene where he's saying, you know, what he believes. And
then he turns around and has a quiet smile to himself, and he thinks it's amusing.
Well, that he's taught them well, basically.
Yeah.
You know.
But also there's like a little, there's a wink and a nod, I feel like, to that. And I do think
so militant about it.
No, agreed. It's very.
And he goes out and saves someone's life because he doesn't want to see someone die. You know, like that's all very clear.
Yeah.
But he struck me as a real person. And
agreed.
And I thought that's the thing that I think halfway through, this doesn't really apply to the race relation conversation, but the personhood kind of starts to go away and it turns into an action movie. I don't know. A movie that even just throws that shit out there and does it in a halfway honest way, I'm down. Yeah. I'll just let it.
It didn't bug me. I just noticed it because it felt anachronistic and sort of very mid-90s.
I have a trivia question for you.
Yeah.
What movie from 1995?
Yeah. Yeah, great.
References both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and only one in the context of that will be our future president.
Die Hard.
Sub question: which one does it say will be president?
It's the taken for granted that Hillary Clinton is going to be the 43rd president of the United States in 1995, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and Donald Trump is referenced here.
Yeah,
and Hillary Clinton is referenced.
Yeah, now she was not senator of New York at this time.
No,
this is before that.
Yeah,
and can I ask you just what was the? I didn't understand the joke, because the joke is, this is a tiny point, but they're driving fast. They're always driving fast across New York in this story, and a woman in a car cuts them off. And John McClane goes, "Whoa, who do you think you are, Hillary Clinton?"
Yeah,
I don't get it.
Yeah,
do you?
Well, she's a bossy woman, I guess. Yeah, bossy, takes what she wants.
Cuts him off?
Yeah, she took what she wanted, which is that parking
Damn,
space or whatever.
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton, it's... I think the end joke all here is there's a Clinton dynasty forming that Hillary Clinton is going to succeed.
Yeah, and there's just a throwaway gag about how fucking rich Donald Trump is. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the whole
thing. Well, yeah, this one girl goes, what, am I going to marry Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Well, like, yeah, I'm going to marry Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk. That's a good bit of trivia. Let's talk for a second about these puzzles.
Okay. Can we just jump to the water jug?
Sure.
So here's what I mean. I remembered this feeling. This came back to me like a missile,
yeah.
Which is like watching the movie and they blast through this water jug puzzle.
Yeah.
And they blast through it so fast. So the gag is they have Simon says, I've given you a 3-gallon water jug and a 5-gallon water jug.
Yeah.
And a bomb that will go off unless you can put precisely 4 gallons of water on the scale.
By the way. One of my favorite things about this film is imagining the prequel to it where Jeremy Irons is going around the city deciding which puzzles to use to set up these things. I think it's awesome.
Well, I like how like kind of out of the school handbook, you know, they are. Like they seem like children's games, basically.
Great.
But so these jugs are sitting on a fountain in a park in New York. So then he's like, you know, you have 4 minutes or whatever. Bye-bye. And then they're like, oh, geez, how do we do this? Like 4 gallons out of these 5 jugs. And he's like, well, maybe if we just kind of estimate. And they're like, no, you got to be precise.
Yeah.
So the first time they just suddenly at the last second, they ram through a solution.
Yeah.
And they get it right and they put it on there. I am convinced that the solution that they ram through, and I rewound it.
Okay.
Makes no sense. And the first time and this time, there's a way easier solution to this problem. So this is what I want to talk about.
Okay. I remember being it the way I would have solved it.
The way they do it?
I think so. I mean, in Kalen's defense, they're confused for 4 minutes and 30 seconds of the 5 minutes. And then at the last 30 seconds, John McClane goes, it's this, blah, 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 blah. And then they do it and it works.
But they've already, he says, I mean, I've fucking watched it. So I want to go through it carefully.
Yeah.
Here's what they say. Uh-huh. He goes, after all this back and forth, he's like, well, the 5-gallon jug has exactly three gallons of water in it, or mm-hmm. three gallons of water in it. This one has 2 gallons of...
Can I tell you what I think he says?
Yeah.
So here's the solution I think that they propose. If not, I'm sorry. Take the 3-gallon jug, fill it up, put 3 gallons into the 5-gallon jug, fill up the 3-gallon jug again... Fill up the 5-gallon jug, which leaves exactly 1 gallon left in the 3-gallon jug.
Yeah.
Empty the 5-gallon jug, put the 1 gallon into the 5-gallon jug, fill up the 3-gallon jug, and now you have 4.
That's the solution I think is correct.
Is that what they say?
No, it isn't. Oh. And I'm pretty sure that's not what they say.
Okay.
Because that's how I would solve it too. And I remember watching this thinking like, okay, I can figure this out. And yeah, that's what I would do. Exactly. Okay. You fill up the 5-gallon water
don't,
jug.
Don't repeat it.
You get it. You heard it. You get it. But on this, they say something very different. And I wonder, is it worth just looking back to see what they say?
Yeah. Did you cue it up?
No.
All right.
We're going to have to maybe take a little beat here.
All right. We're going to do this. This is worth everyone's time.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about while I set this up?
Yeah.
Cut it.
Well, let's talk about some of the other gags. There's a great riddle. Here, you know what? There's a good character moment here. They use a riddle. Well, I have 2 things I want to say about this. One is using the gags to exposit character is... obviously what you should do here. So there's the first riddle that they have to solve together is, you know, a guy, Jack takes a sack to the market and each sack has 7 kittens and each sack has 7 cats, each cat has 7 kittens. How many men are going to the market or something like that? And there's a moment where Samuel L. Jackson says, I'm good at math, shut up, let me do this. He's like, 7 times 7 is 49, 49 times 7 is 243, whatever it is. And you're watching this going, oh, this is great. This guy is really good at math.
Right.
And he's going to solve it for him. And he solves it. He gets to the end of it. And then they try it. It doesn't work. And then he goes, oh, no, it's 1. How many men are going to the market?
Yeah, yeah.
So the fact that the blind alley they go down is used to help exposit character is great. I thought that was really smart and really interesting.
Yeah.
And...
I mean, I know that you're getting to something, but what I also love about that and what is actually carried through consistently is John McClane's pretty dumb.
He's like can't think fast, really. Like, he has instinct, and that's kind of his character.
They keep telling you he's hungover. He's got a headache.
Yeah, he's hungover, and he can't, like, simple math even he can't really seem to do because he's kind of stressed and he's working through it. And so it's kind of it is true that it's a really great attribute to give Samuel L. Jackson, that just because he has a different skill set than McClane. It's valuable that he's here.
One other thing before we watch this jug scene again. I really think it's interesting to task your audience during a scene, because part of the joy of this is Caitlin is freeze framed on a 3-gallon jug and a 5-gallon jug. Some have water in each of them. But to task your audience with a fun puzzles are fun. Everyone likes puzzles. And so you're watching this movie and you're part of your brain's trying to sort out the puzzle before they do. That's just part of the joy of watching this. And also, there's good, funny dialogue going on. It's a really pleasurable experience to give your audience things to do on their own while they're watching the narrative unfold.
And
I love the idea
of that. People you like and characters you like and, you know, just a city that sort of feels like a city. I mean, like, this movie, when it's at its best, which I would kind of argue this jug scene and the subway scene and stuff, like, it's fucking killing it. Yeah. Like, this, it's got a really beautiful collection of elements.
I wonder if they just knew, you know what's fun? Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson solving puzzles. That's going to be great to watch.
Well,
and it is.
It really is. I mean, they cast it beautifully. But what's interesting, as we alluded to at the beginning, is that this was based on an original script called Simon Says.
Yeah.
What I didn't realize is that I knew Die Hard 1 was based on a book, and they changed it a lot. Die Hard 2 was also based on a book, which was not a sequel to the Die Hard 1 book.
What is happening?
So there's an interesting like history of taking stuff meant for other things and scooping it into the Die Hard world. Even more crazy than that?
Tell me.
Simon Says was originally written to be an individual thing for, you know, like a and Samuel L. Jackson was supposed to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work out. So they bought it to make it into Lethal Weapon 3.
What?
Then that didn't work out. The rights lapsed. Meanwhile, they've been hunting for a new Die Hard for like 5 years since the last movie.
Yeah.
Then they're like, okay, that thing, we're making it Die Hard now. And we're going to add the Samuel L. Jackson character. Isn't that crazy?
It's very successful. That is really crazy to think about that development process.
Yeah, because this
is
feels...
Another Day to Die Hard. Is that the name of that one?
Yeah.
Is that based on existing
Live Free to Die? Live Free or Die Hard, I think, is 4. And Another Day to Die Hard is... Or Good Day to Die Hard is 5.
Are those based on...
No.
They're meant to be. They're written. They hired someone and said, "Give us a Die Hard 4."
I guess.
Huh.
And you know, to me, I haven't seen those movies. I hear they're really horrible, but I can't imagine. This is really my hang-up about ever wanting to watch those films. I cannot imagine a Die Hard movie where Bruce Willis is bald, like straight up bald.
Right.
It really bugs me. That is not this guy. That is a different guy. And I couldn't tell you why I feel that way.
Yeah.
But when he's shaved clean, that's not John McClane.
He's a good amount of bald in this movie.
I love it.
Yeah, it's the right amount
of
bald.
It's perfect. Yeah. He's a perfect guy. Yeah. Like a beat down, kind of schlubby, but fucking
but
really
tough.
Yeah, but he'll never quit. I mean, that's so I read somewhere somebody said that, you know, the key to an action hero and is you there's a lot of things that you can do to make it better. But all what people identify with most, and this applies to the Fast and Furious series, it applies to Indiana Jones, is they don't stop. They will not quit. And that people love that.
Mm.
And that is something that people can really invest themselves in. And, I mean, of course, that sounds probably obvious when you think about any action movie ever. But he's perfect because he's getting
great.
Beat to fucking shit in, like, every scene. And he doesn't stop.
Yeah.
He has every reason to. You know, he's not even really doing it because he's such a good guy. He just won't stop.
Yeah, yeah. And there's never the sense that he might. He never stops to consider that.
Right.
All right, stand by while we watch this jug scene. We'll be right back.
We got less than a minute. Throw this thing away.
Look, we can't take it off and it'll detonate. Just wait. Wait a second. Wait a second. I got it. Exactly 2 gallons in here, right?
Right.
Leaving exactly 1 gallon of empty space, right?
Yeah.
A full 5 gallons here, right?
Right.
You pour 1 gallon out of 5 gallons into there, we have exactly 4 gallons in there.
Yes!
Yeah.
Okay, we watched it.
It checks out.
It checks out, but doesn't it feel more complicated?
It does. Here's their solution. You fill up the 5 gallon jug. Stop me if I get this wrong. You fill up the 5 gallon jug. You pour 3 gallons of that into the 3 gallon jug. You empty the 3 gallon jug. You have 2 gallons now in the 5 gallon jug. You put those 2 gallons into the 3 gallon jug. So now you have an empty 5 gallon jug and you have a 3 gallon jug with 2 gallons of water in it. You fill up the 5 gallon jug and then you pour 1 gallon, filling the three gallon jug up, leaving 4 gallons of water behind in the 5 gallon jug.
Yeah. So that's what happens. Yeah. But they skip all this context. I mean, I'm not now like the movie works, I guess it works, but they skip all the context that would give you any sense of what they're talking about.
You know
about.
What it is.
The dialogue
I think they realize no one gives a shit. I'm sure that's it.
I'm sure that's it. Yeah. But it seems so simple. So the way the scene starts is they're arguing. They've got two jugs.
I hope we spend 20 minutes.
How did they get to this position and not know what they were doing? Like, so John McClane goes, he's sitting there and he goes, hold on. Okay, I got it. I got 2 gallons of water in here, right? You got 5 gallons in there. You've seen nothing up until this point.
Well, you've seen him fill up and pour out a bunch of water.
But you don't know, they haven't said, you haven't seen anything. Yeah. He says, I got 2 gallons in here. You got 5 gallons in there, right? Pour 1 gallon in here. You got 4 gallons in there.
Yeah.
And then he's like, okay, good.
Once you get to this point, the problem really does solve itself. But I made Kaelin stop. I'm like, how do you get to here? And it took us a good minute to be like, how could we possibly get to this scenario?
Yeah.
And we figured it out.
So how did they get into it without knowing what they were doing? They were just pouring water back and forth.
Is it four yet? They're just talking and they're talking back and forth, and Samuel L. Jackson goes, how much time do we have? Oh shit, less than a minute. So for 4 minutes they've been pouring water back and forth and just being like, do we have four? Is this three? What is this? One?
I also love the pre-internetness of this movie, which is like a puzzle movie would be a real bitch to do right now because Google it. Could just look up anything. I mean, they might say, like, we've disabled your phones. But, like, a big portion of this film is not knowing who the 21st president of the United States is, which is great.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't know. I certainly didn't know.
I did not know.
And I was like, God, I'm so dumb. Like, how annoying that I don't know the answer to this. But it really puts you in that position. And I didn't, you know, I could have looked it up or whatever. But, like, it puts you in that position of frustration of, like, where's the fucking knowledge? Yeah. Like, where's a person I can get this from?
Yeah.
And they ask people and they don't know.
It's great.
And they finally get to some guy who happens to know his president.
Not just some guy. This ridiculous truck driver who's giving he's probably autistic. He's giving a tour of the aqueducts to John McClane, who's like, you know, and they're spilling out necessary information, like every 2 miles there's a stop gap here, there's a release valve, which comes into play later, but it's just buried in this boring tour. And then John McClane is like, who's the 21st president? He goes, Chester A. Arthur.
Yeah.
And then from 1864 to 1868, vice president. He all he had to do to solve this riddle is meet an autistic truck driver, and then we have it. Like, we solved the
But it
the
doesn't
problem.
Play, like, overly convenient, because what John McClane is doing is he says, like, well, I got to go find a way to call this other guy to ask him who the fucking 21st president is. And this guy goes, oh, I know that.
Yeah.
And, like, it plays actually very real to me.
Yeah, and also what also makes it real is John McClane then does nothing with that information.
Well, exactly. And it turns out that whole thing is another red herring, which, again, weirdly, I totally forgive in this movie because it's exciting.
It's not a red herring. It ends up being true, but not necessary. Like, it is Chester A. Arthur elementary school.
But what I mean is, like, it's they've put a bomb in this school building where Samuel L. Jackson's nephews go to school, and they get stuck in the building, and this guy is trying to defuse the bomb, and he's clipping wires.
I want to go
stuff.
Back to this, but go on.
Okay, sure. It's not a bomb. It's not a real bomb. No. But the whole gag of the thing is, like, that wasn't even real.
It was a distraction to get us off the ship.
Yeah.
To get to the ship. So there's this, they get to Chester A. Arthur Elementary School with about 25 minutes to spare to disarm this bomb. And this guy, who has been in the entire movie as a bomb geek, he comes in, he's the one who exposits how the bombs work. He's like, this is an amazing thing. He's this weird, geeky, nerdy dude who is given credibility in the film. He's like, he knows what he's talking about.
It's very interesting. He's the comical Q character, if he was a little bit incompetent, in like the New York kind of blue-collar version of that. And he has this actually a great moment, which I was very surprised pays off in a funny way, where he shows how mixing a tiny amount of the chemicals can create a small explosion. And then they do that later on when they free Samuel L. Jackson from the handcuffs. And that hurts him. I love it. I love these details in the movie. I really love it. But anyway.
So this guy has been exposited as a character with some degree of competency. And he gets to the school with plenty of time to defuse this bomb. He's the one who spots what the bomb is. And he's like, okay, cool. Let's get everybody out of here. Give me some time. And you show it. It cuts back to him maybe 7 times to show him working. And he's always fiddling with something.
Yeah.
He's just doing some stuff. And I kept thinking, what is he doing? Like, what is he doing? I want to know. Show me what he's doing. But the movie doesn't know.
Yeah.
So it doesn't show you. Because then no one knows how the fuck to defuse this. Because it's a bullshit bomb. So he's like futzing with it, and then it cuts back to him, and he's sweatier, and he's still working. He's like, I need more time. And it cuts back to him, and now he's got powder he's pulled out of his, like, baseball player side pouch that he's, like, powdering his hands, and he gets the powder on his face, and he's going through it. And then it cuts to him, and he's got pliers, and he's like,
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Before this, yeah. there's more because uh-huh. I love what you're about to do and what you're about to talk about. Yeah. But it becomes this tiny little character portrait of like decency and integrity
yeah.
because they tell him like, look, we're out of time. We're going to just run these kids out of the school, which the bad guy said, don't do. And so, and he's like, no, give me 30 more seconds. I know I can get this thing. And they're like, you got to leave, bro. And so he's like, fuck, fine. And he gets up and he starts to leave. And then they find out there are some kids in the classroom that are locked in the classroom. So they got to send a couple of cops back in there. So he's like, I'm staying. I'm in. And I'm going to try to keep finishing this thing
yeah.
for those kids, for myself. It doesn't matter. But the thing is, none of it matters.
Well, I'm thinking, awesome. This yeah. is cool. Good
he's
guy.
Great. It's great. But yeah, I love this anyway. Yeah. Like, I love that all for all of those
totally.
Reasons.
Up to this point, I'm still, I mean, listen, I never get out of this. There's no turn coming
yeah.
here. But
yeah.
but up to this point, I'm way in the movie logic. And then, seventh time it cuts back to him, he's like, no guts, no glory or something.
Yeah.
And then there's only two wires going to the bomb, and he cuts one of them. And you're like, wait. So this whole time you've been futzing, have you been tracing the wire? What have you been messing with for 25 minutes if the solution is to cut the wire? And then the bomb keeps going. He's like, oh, no, that didn't work. And so then he cuts the other wire. And then it sprays, jelly all over him or whatever, because it's not real bomb juice. It's just jelly juice.
Well, I know. The idea is like, that ultimately, if all he had was cut all the wires.
But here's the thing. It wasn't like, I'm out of ideas. I have to cut the wires. He's like, here we go.
Yeah.
I've worked all this time to build up to cutting this wire
and
then cutting the second wire.
Cutting the wire makes a, like, like... You can't do that on television style stream of red juice spray directly into his face.
Into his like third eye, just on his forehead. It just doing some right there.
It's great.
But
and
what
then
a crazy
like,
idea.
He's like jelly or jam or syrup
yeah.
or whatever he says.
I love the idea that the movie's like, we don't know how this thing works. What could he be doing for 25 minutes? Just don't show it. Show a shot of his face because
yeah.
it doesn't make any sense.
He sells it. That
he
guy
sells
sold it.
It
to me.
That's what's so disappointing because I bought all of it until
yeah.
I get to the point where he's like, here we go. I'm finally ready to cut the wire.
And what's weird, I mean, it's not weird, but like then that guy's not in the movie anymore.
Yeah, yeah, he's done.
I got one more piece of trivia about how they made this film.
I'm ready.
If you'd like to hear
it. I would love to hear it, Kalen.
Had a different ending. You didn't like the last 5 minutes?
Did not
like
it.
Well, it had a very different last 5 minutes.
Oh, tell me this. Maybe it's better.
I haven't seen this, but apparently it's on the DVD.
They shot it.
And stuff. They shot it.
Oh.
It was that Jeremy Irons gets away. Scot-free, gets all the money, gets out of there. McClane is disgraced. He's booted off the force. He descends into alcoholism. Presumably, he never gets together with his wife. His, burgeoning friendship with Zeus is over and done.
Oh, we forgot to mention Samuel L. Jackson's character name is Zeus.
Which is a really hacky introduction, which I think I loved,
yeah.
is that the guys who know him from the neighborhood go, hey, Zeus, who's this guy, when he's wearing the sandwich board, and blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, so... Hey Zeus, that's your name? And he's like, no, my name's not Hey Zeus. It's Zeus. They said, Hey Zeus. And yeah. like, it's just so weird.
And the speech that follows that is dumb. Anyway.
Well, then he says, I'll jam a lightning bolt up your ass.
Amongst other ridiculous
things.
Yeah,
but that's cool. I liked it.
Is it? Not quite clear. Anyway, so what's the ending?
So, like, a long time later, like maybe months, weeks, years, I don't know how much time later, McClane, all by himself, Point Break style, tracks this guy down and gets it using that little bottle, which is also a clue in this ending, this original ending. So basically, Jeremy Irons accidentally gives McClane a clue to his whereabouts. And in the film, that clue leads to a 5-minute action finale where they shoot down a helicopter, basically.
Mm.
And in this version, he uses it to much later track him down at some sort of, rest stop in Hungary or something, and the details I'm fuzzy on, but somehow he's set up that there is a like low grade missile, and you can't tell which way it will shoot. It will either shoot forward or backward, and so he forces Jeremy Irons to play a game of
Princess Bride style,
yeah,
huh.
where he's like, which way is it going to go, and like they pick one or whatever, or like he guesses something wrong. And it goes off and shoots him and, like, blows him up, also True Lies style. Like,
mm-hmm,
the thing takes him off. And then you find out McClane was wearing some kind of protective vest, which had it shot him, he would have been fine already.
But it didn't shoot him. So why would it?
Well, because he's a cool guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't play by the rules.
Okay.
And so the studio, look, I know that sounds like, I don't know what I'm talking about. I haven't seen it. I just read about this.
Yeah.
And the studio was like, well, that's weird because it makes him this venge-seeking weirdo. He's not really a hero. Yeah. And it's not an action scene. It's this weird sort of mano-a-mano revenge thing, which the title maybe suggests it might go that way. And this sort of cycle of revenge back and forth is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to see if it was cool. But what they have now is not very good. Mm-hmm. You know, so one way or another, and they had, I know that it said that the studio went back and reshot that whole thing at a great deal of expense because it's a big scene.
It's a big sequence, yeah. I don't know which of those I prefer, to be honest with you.
They might neither be any good.
Yeah, it feels like there's a couple things you have to do. One, this idea of vengeance and making some sense of the fact that this is Hans Gruber's brother, Simon Gruber. Makes sense to me. And also the idea that a guy obsessed with details and puzzles will be betrayed by a micro detail he hasn't thought through. He's thought right. through everything, and he's laid out traps everywhere, and he's gone through and put jugs next to water fountains and little ball games next to, you know, right. Where do the Yankees play? Where Yankee Stadium. Yeah. You know, all this stuff. By the way, what happened in Yankee Stadium?
I have no idea.
It's weird, right? There must have been something cut.
Yeah.
Because of the line, he goes, I went to all that trouble to set up Yankee Stadium. That's regretful.
Well, he had another plan there, but he decided to abandon it because they convinced him that they should just assassinate John.
Yeah, but then Samuel L. Jackson goes there, finds a little puzzle game. Taped underneath it is the words game over.
Yeah.
And then he leaves.
He figured that they would get shot. They don't shoot him because McClane isn't with them, and they don't want to just shoot somebody.
But then that doesn't make sense. He's like, I went to all that trouble to set that up. Was the game, they find this and we shoot him? That's what he went to the trouble to set up?
No, he had something else set up. And then they abandoned that.
I don't like that.
It's dumb.
Yeah.
And also the idea that, like, I don't want to shoot this innocent, even though he's blown up a department store full of human beings,
doesn't make any sense. Nonsense. I would have been very content. I think they had to have give Samuel L. Jackson's character something to do in that moment is probably what that's for, that why they kept it in. But you could cut that whole sequence, and I'd be totally fine with it.
Sure.
Because it doesn't make a lick of sense.
Doesn't make sense.
Anyway, the way this ends, so I understand the need for both those things. The way this ends, which sounds like it's in both endings, is John McClane's been asking for aspirin the whole movie. At the end, he's about to get blown up, and he asks Simon Gruber, Hans Gruber's brother, if he has any aspirin. He throws him a bottle of aspirin. Underneath it is the name of the station, the immigration point where he bought the aspirin that he's been, I guess, keeping in his very tight pant pocket the entire film, and throws it to him, and that's the clue that gets him there. I get the structural need for that. I like the idea that a small micro detail gives him away. I don't like that detail.
Well, you don't like that detail?
I just don't think
I think it's good. Fine. It's not great. But it's fine. What I don't like is the sequence that follows, which is textbook. It's like textbook studio reshoot.
Yeah.
It is like the definition of studio reshoot, because after all this adventure, again, with these people who I've grown to like quite a bit, even though it's gone a little over the top, suddenly, Samuel L. Jackson's in a helicopter with John McClane going chasing down this guy in Canada. No fucking way.
Yeah.
And like, they just had to put these, they're like, well, the audience likes him. They're buddies now. He has to go. Mm-hmm. He has to be there for the ending. We will not accept an ending where he is not there. Yeah. And so then they have this dumb kind of half-assed action scene where there's a couple of helicopters shooting at each other. I mean, in this case, this is where True Lies has it over this movie, is that its finale is actually a finale.
Yeah.
And this is a nothing.
And I will not get bogged down on this, but this whole... So Jeremy Irons has a rotating machine gun, just this massive amount of bullets. He's got the high ground, he's in a helicopter. He is, as we know, militarily trained. He's a very clever guy, very good tactician. And then he probably shoots 1,000 bullets at an open John McClane running through the parking lot. And it hits none of him. It's such a movie trope. I don't want to get bogged down in it.
Right.
But for that character and that moment, it felt ridiculous.
Well, and it doesn't feel like Die Hard. I mean, frankly, like, you know, I can't speak to Die Hard 2. I haven't seen it in a very long time. But in Die Hard and in Die Hard 1 and in this movie, often people will get shot and they'll get hit and they'll get stabbed and they'll they're mortals in this movie.
Yeah.
And in that scene, sequences like it, and what I assume, I'm guessing the you know, fourth and fifth, I think he becomes just a Superman, and it's who cares?
There's a great moment. There's a really, really good moment. There's a Dallas here. We have a Dallas here.
This guy's having some real issues. I could hear him.
Hey,
crying.
Dal.
Come here, man.
He was fine for so long, and then all of a sudden he was just like, nah.
Hi.
Scream.
Do you have anything Dallas? To say now that you're safe? Now that you're safe away from your sister? Do you want to say something? Yeah, what would you like to say? Can you say hello? You're hitting the mic. That's not talking. Can you sing a song, maybe? Okay. Yeah.
Oh, what was I about to say? It was. It was
sorry.
It was
you,
oh, I don't shit, know. Shit. Hold on. Oh, so let's pick up here. You can cut this part out. There's a scene I really, really love. So Samuel L. Jackson and John McClane are on to. I just refuse to call him Zeus, is why I keep saying his full name.
Well.
I'll try it. So Zeus and John McClane are on the ship, and they got on there on a very ridiculous
way. Yeah, why aren't we calling him Bruce Willis? What's up?
I don't know. John McClane's just a cooler name.
John McClane is that iconic?
Yeah, I think so. I think
and Samuel L. Jackson is that iconic. All right. Yeah. I've solved
it
for myself.
I picked the two biggest versions of knowing those people. So anyway, they split up. They go. John McClane gets in a fight with this massive, like 10-foot-tall supervillain guy. And then Samuel L. Jackson, who has a beautiful moment where he's like, I don't know how to work this gun. And then John McClane goes, what? He goes, not all black people know how to use guns.
Right.
Whatever. And then he goes, you pull this slide back, it arms it, you pull the trigger, that's it. Great. That moment feels cohesive and justified in itself. He sneaks up, goes up to the bridge where this woman henchman we haven't discussed yet is there, who has zero lines in the film.
She's a mute.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, is she mute and deaf because they tried to assassinate her?
I think it's just cool. Well, she has her throat cut, which is interesting. Ah. She has scars on her throat, okay. So maybe she is mute. Anyway, he sneaks up. There's four guys on the bridge. Simon Gruber, Hans Gruber's brother, is facing outward, and he's wearing this baby blue sleeveless tee, and it's very
looking
tight.
Looking good.
And Samuel Jackson goes, don't move. And he's got the gun, and Simon Gruber turns around eating a hard-boiled egg. And he takes this massive bite of a hard-boiled egg, and it's the perfect villain moment. And I kept thinking, was Jeremy Irons like, you know what would be cool if I was eating an egg here? Like, if you just, somehow on the ship, I got an egg.
Such a weird thing to want to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, and he turns around, and he's so unperturbed by Zeus. And Samuel L. Jackson, they have a little brief moment. Samuel L. Jackson pulls the trigger, nothing happens. He pulls it again, nothing happens. And still eating the hard-boiled egg, Simon Gruber walks over and takes the gun and goes, you got to turn the safety off, and then shoots him in the leg. It's great.
It's great.
It's so die-hardist.
I mean, it's typical of this film that they do something, and the race relation thing maybe applies here, is that it's totally cliche from action cinema. The bad guy would be dead had the good guy known to turn the safety off. How many times have you seen that? And it's not that it's done so much better here. They just pack it full of weird character.
He's eating
detail.
A hard-boiled egg,
and it makes all the difference. It makes it fun and funny. Like the movie is fun and funny like that.
It makes
a lot
it
of these
so
scenes.
Absurd and fantastic.
Whoa. Okay.
Any closing thoughts on? I would say watch this film.
It's very enjoyable. I mean, watch Die Hard 1 and watch this. You'll have a good time. I mean, this movie is not the equal of Die Hard in terms of action. You know, perfection and adventure perfection, but it's close. It's a really good time.
Even having seen a lot of action films recently that are modern action films, I would argue that these sequences are better. They're clearly practical. I hate to keep hitting that, but it looks so different to your eye and things move differently, and it's really satisfying, and it feels like a massive budget practical effect film that's shot exquisitely.
Well,
the
that's the thing.
Are
this
great.
It Dallas, chill out, man. It comes down to McTiernan. I mean, it comes down to that guy being a tremendous filmmaker. And we've now seen two films of his, and we haven't talked about the fact that he has been booted from the face of the earth after going to prison for stuff that I guess we don't need to get into right now, just because
Google it, you guys will see. Yeah.
Google it, you'll find out why one of the great action filmmakers of our all time is no longer working. Not that I'm defending him.
No. Same. I realized when I said it came out like I was. Anyway, I'm not defending
it. It does suck because he made awesome movies, but we have a few great ones. And this, I would qualify as one of the really strong John McTiernan movies.
Agreed.
You know? The other thing I want to say very, very, very quickly is, coming as it does a year after Pulp Fiction, where these guys have found indie stardom in a really interesting way, I think they bring a little of that spirit in here. I mean, Bruce Willis literally quotes one of his Pulp Fiction lines where he references that Counting Flowers on the Wall song, where he repeats some of the lyrics of that song. There's a scene where he blows someone's head off. They don't specifically reference Pulp Fiction, but how do they come up with that scene if not for Pulp Fiction, where he blows someone's head around an entire elevator? And Samuel L. Jackson is riding high off of his triumph as Jules Winfield. It's a very different character, and one that I think that he plays, it's closer, It's closer to some, like, the character he plays in, like, Changing Lanes and in some of his more serious dramatic work. And
it's very nerdy, and I love
it. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it reminds me a lot of Changing Lanes, which is a great underappreciated film, also set in New York, where he's at maybe one of his best performances ever. And this reminded me a little bit of that, in just that he is a... Of course he's a personality, of course he's a character, but this and Pulp Fiction and stuff like Changing Lanes and lots of other stuff, he is a great actor. Mm-hmm. I really think he is really, really valuable, not just as a cool, great film presence, but like, the guy can fucking act, and he elevates a crazy, silly movie like this to a place that feels human. I don't know.
I agree. So quickly, let's just talk about what's happening.
You go for it.
So Kaylin and I
mentioned this a little bit last week.
Yeah, Kaylin and I have a show that's being filmed, an episode of a television show, and Kaylin is working as an executive producer on the project and is going out to Chicago to be on set for some of it, and I'll be joining him for our episode.
Well, we're being extremely coy.
I think we
can say this. Okay. People know the show exists. Okay. It's called Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams, and we wrote an episode based on the short story Foster, You're Dead. So far, it's been a ton of fun, and we haven't even gotten to set yet. So I'm going out there for a month. We've pre-recorded a bunch of episodes. Travis is going to come join me. We're going to record an episode in Chicago, if all goes according to plan. But for this episode and... I guess the one last week and the one next week and the one after, we've recorded all of those before I take
off. So the next episode you're going to hear, we're not going to pull from the bag this week because my little sister is going to be a guest on the episode, and we're going to figure out a movie that she wants to watch. She's 18, has a weird Christian Slater obsession, that's all I know. And we're going to try to figure out what she wants to watch next week. So
well, we're being coy. I think it's okay to say we already did this, so we're just doing a little bit of acting right here. But we're not going to give you any insight.
Well, that's the thing, though. That's what. But we said on that one.
But on that episode, we said whatever. It's we know what we watched, but you'll find out next week.
Yeah, but I'm setting you up for. We should talk this beforehand.
You were making this sincere face at me like you really believe these words you're saying.
Well, no, I'm just saying that we're going to work it out.
We already did.
Yes,
we
but for the listeners.
I know, but don't act at me.
I'm acting for the listener.
I would have preferred it if you'd been winking at me.
I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't even making eye contact with you.
You seemed like you were trying to
I was looking past
sincere.
You. I was just saying we're going. Listen, here's the reason we're not pulling a movie. Is because we're going to figure out live on air what... we're going to watch in the reality of this time frame, which is...
And in the reality of my world, we already did all this.
Oh, God.
So enjoy it. It's a good one.
This is ridiculous. All right. Yeah. Okay. So join us next week where we do a movie that we already know what it is, but you guys don't know yet on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?